Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Peggy Billings. Billings was for many years involved with the national offices of the United Methodist Church. She has devoted her life to human rights, civil rights, women's, and peace issues. From 1952 to 1963, she served as a missionary in war-torn South Korea. In September of this year, she released her first book of poetry called Half Light, published by Ithaca's Vista Periodista Press. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Thank you.
Now, you've committed your whole life to social justice and civil rights and peace and so on. And did this stem from something in your childhood, or is this something that you learned as you got more involved in the United Methodist Church?
I think I have to say that deep in my mind were thoughts of these issues. We didn't think of them as issues in those days. We just thought of how we lived. And as a child, of course, you're unaware of your surroundings, except that you're happy and having a good time. But I grew up in Mississippi, mm-hmm. in rural and small town Mississippi, segregated Mississippi, into two worlds, black and white. And although we were side by side, and in many cases quite close, we knew that we were in two separate worlds. I had that sense from early on, and it bothered me. Mm. I remember that. And I remember in high school one time visiting from our white high school, which was, goodness knows, not that well equipped. we visited a black high school. I don't know why, I don't know who took us there, but it was a class, a visit. And I remember being shocked at the few books on the shelves in the library and the few test tubes in the chemistry classroom. That made a real impression on me. And in college, I became more active and more aware. As the years went by, I was very much impressed. And Korea finally drove that home to me.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. There was all this work to do in Mississippi where you were brought up, but you ended up going to South Korea.
Yeah, this had always been a childhood dream of mine. Hmm. I don't know where it came from. I went to a small Methodist church, and we were taught by good people, Sunday school teachers and youth workers and our ministers. And I had the idea. My grandfather had been a circuit rider in North Mississippi, and I didn't know him. He died long before I was born. But my grandmother was, his widow, was a great influence on me. And I don't remember her ever talking to me about being, quote, a missionary, but I got the sense of wanting to do good from her.
How did you get interested in South Korea, though?
I was interested in China. That's the only place I heard of, and I wanted to go there. But this was long ago in 19, when I got out of college and went to graduate school. It was 1950, and the Korean War had started in June of that year, mm-hmm. and it wasn't possible for me to go there. So the people who were recruiting me asked me China, the people had come out of China. This was 50-51, and people were leaving China because of the change in government there to a communist government, and they were asking foreign religious people to leave. So they said, would you consider going to Korea? And I said, yes. That was as simple as that. It was close to China. That's all I knew.
So you're attracted to the Asian cultures.
I was very much attracted to Asia for some reason. And I felt at home there from the beginning.
And then, so tell us a little bit about your experiences.
January. I went to Japan in the fall of 1952, and the war was going on in Korea. So civilian missionaries, women particularly, were not allowed to go. If you were a medical person, you could go into South Korea because in an emergency you could be of some help. But if you weren't, you'd just be in the way. And another friend and I were sent to Hiroshima. And that was an incredible four-month experience of waiting to go into South Korea. It's a long story, Hiroshima, and you know all of the all of the things that surround it. And it was a very, very memorable experience for me, and began to turn me to think in terms of this whole the issue of peace and war. And then went on over to Korea. I was relief work and youth work for a while in Busan, which was the so-called refugee capital of the Republic of Korea, South Korea at that time. And I was there for 2 years, and then I was sent up to Seoul, the capital city, after the war ended in July of 1953. I went up there in and opened up again after the war a very large social center, which had activities of all kinds before the war, and which had to be started up again. So I spent almost 8 years there in Seoul.
Mm-hmm. And so your experience in South Korea, how did you enact it in the United States? I know you came back to the U.S. a couple months before the JFK assassination
in
63.
The thing that, you know, your worlds can be so separate from each other, and you don't realize that until you start seeing things that are happening. Things were happening to my college classmates back in Mississippi. They were being run out of the state for doing nothing other than saying, you know, as Christians we should love one another. You know, nothing more dangerous than that, and yet they were run out of the state. And so I was concerned about that. I began to, of course, I had learned to see the complexities of Korean society with the reconstruction after the war and all the terrible things that had gone on and things that needed to be done, and see what was happening in the lives of my students and friends. And it began to occur to me that there's an interrelationship between all these things, that what's going on in South Korea and what's going on in Mississippi are not unrelated, and that I could probably do as much good or maybe even more back home than I could in Korea. The Koreans are quite self-sufficient. Didn't need me.
So you did come back, and you continued your work in civil and human rights.
I continued. I was in the national office of the United Methodist, and I was able, given an opportunity to work in race relations, and this took me back home to Mississippi. But again, it was a divided Mississippi, because at this point, if you were working on relations between blacks and whites, and if you were working cooperatively with blacks, a lot of people in Mississippi didn't take kindly to that. Mm-hmm. And so I would go home, and I would be on the other side, you know, of Mississippi from the one I had grown up in. I continued to go and see my family. My brothers and sister, my sister were still there. And I wanted to visit them, and I did, and they always welcomed me. There's never any problem there. But there were some problems that I'd rather not go into that concerned my family, the loss of one of my brothers. It was a difficult time for me personally and for my family. And finally I decided it might be well for a period of time not to, after the March on Selma, which I attended and where I did some work. I thought maybe it'd be good not to go home for a while. So I took there was a hiatus of about 3 years when I didn't go, but gradually things worked out, and there it was possible to, you know, to be with my family and continue my work, and to be with my friends and continue my work, and gradually you know, added other issues that I worked on. Like, women's issues became very big, and the issues of concerning
you got involved in the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam. Somewhat. Oh, yeah. It was
that permeated the whole.
Oh, it permeated
as well.
The whole society, yeah. And it was really traumatic and strain producing, of course. But it was also a struggle for those of us who had worked so hard in racial justice to see the energy having to be used necessarily on the Vietnam War. That was a big, you know, it was a big strain for Dr. King and many of the leaders of the civil rights movement to see the linkage between, you know, to have to give energy to the linkage mm-hmm. between the civil rights movement and the anti-war peace movement. Mm-hmm. But people did it.
Yeah.
Had to.
Now, let's, we could talk about this for hours. Let's talk about the fact that 10 years ago you began writing some poetry.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And it seems to me you captured your autobiography in these 10 years of poems. You just published the book in September called Half Light, which contains all these poems. To tell us about how you got involved in writing poetry.
Well,
relatively late in life as well.
Well, it is late. I said I didn't expect to win any prizes because you get a late start and you don't have the time or energy to be doing all the things you have to do in the world of poetry to be a part of it. But it was something I'd always been interested in, never had the leisure for. Upon coming here and living again in the rural area, I was very much taken back to my roots. And I thought I also was having a vision problem. I'm now legally blind, and I thought, well, if I can't, you know, be running around very, very much, I think that maybe I should get involved in something. I love to read, but I can't read anymore, and so something that's short, you know. Mm-hmm. And stick to short poems and give it a try. So I met Bridget Meads here in Ithaca, and Bridget had some workshops, and I attended those and met some other good women poets and some men poets and became friends with some of them. And we, you know, started working. I worked with Bridget and started learning some of the forms of poetry, which I had not had time to study. And so I wanted to learn the forms and then try to, excuse me, find my own voice, to use a cliche.
Mm-hmm. Had you read a lot of poetry prior to this?
Read a lot of poetry since school. In school, you know, I did, but mm-hmm. I hadn't read a lot of poetry in between. But I have tried to catch up somewhat, though I still, mm-hmm. excuse me, feel, you know, unversed really in the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Well, but this is a medium that everybody can use, is what I think.
Yes, yes, I find my poems getting shorter and shorter and slimmer, but that's okay.
Your stuff is beautiful. Can I have you read a poem for us? I know you want to read Snow Before Winter.
Yes, I'll try to recite that. This is a poem that kind of pulls together Ithaca and the past. Who would have expected snow so soon? The fields are lost. So is the wheelbarrow left leaning against the shed. Gutters, uncluttered of leaves, sag, and the empty bird feeder swings in an aimless arc. The snow shovel is buried behind rakes and digging forks. Only the ice salt with its plastic spade is in its place by the side door. We go out in a jumble of gloves and scarves and hats to excavate the car. Downtown in Ithaca, DeWitt Park trees still have all their leaves, yellow, red, even green, but white trimmed now. A wild mix of dress to rival ours. I go on my own to wander in and out of shops. Emerging from one, I feel lost in the cold fading light. It is only 3 p.m., but the world is turned on edge. Sidewalks slant. Signs waver and blur. I turn back toward the library. Though no cars are coming, I wait for the light at Cayuga and Buffalo. Is this how the astronauts felt, leaving Earth for the moon? Did the first sea creature to flop up on land gasp for breath like this? What I'm really asking is, if I will survive the Darwinian leap of another Ithaca winter, or did I grow one set of gills too many in Mississippi's humid heat, which, though vestigial, will always ache in Arctic air?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peggy Billings. She just published her first book of poetry called Half Light. That was a beautiful poem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the line really took me. Did I grow one set of gills too many in Mississippi's humid heat? Do you think we're always going to be from where we were brought up and born and raised? Or is there a way to get away from our past?
Well, I think most of us who grow up in, I don't know, maybe it's just Southerners. I don't think it is, because people I know here in Ithaca who have such a tremendous sense of place. I think it's that sense of place. If you have that, I think you don't leave there ever. Some people are happy to be away, you know, from where they're from, for reasons of their own. And have other people have, you know, lived in so many different places that it's hard for them to identify one place as that place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I certainly don't feel that I can escape those roots. And what I've been trying to do in these poems, I mean, this big triangle, I call it, of Mississippi and then Korea and then back to New York and living in Manhattan and traveling all over the country and the world, trying to make a kind of circle out of that triangle.
Mm.
And that's what I've been trying to do with my poems. It hasn't completely happened yet, but I think it is happening.
There's time. Now, I understand that you write your poems in your head and then you translate them onto paper. Is that true?
Yes.
How does the transition work?
I don't know.
No, I mean,
it's kind of a mystery.
When you write it down, do you change a lot? Does it seem different to you once you've put it on paper?
It depends on the poem. Some poems really just come complete, almost complete,
mm-hmm.
and there's very little work to do, particularly some of the shorter poems. Other longer poems where I'm really searching through that poem for the resolution of some experience, they are longer poems, and it does take time, and you do have to do a lot of revision. You get a phrase, though. I think there's always either a phrase that comes to you or some idea that you try to translate immediately into a phrase if you don't get one. But you're really, really lucky if you get a phrase or if you get a full sentence sometimes. Sometimes it's just a word.
Mm-hmm.
And you've heard that word and used that word over and over again, but suddenly it sounds different.
Mm-hmm.
And it manifests itself different. But some, you know, as I say, they kind of come full grown, and you're lucky there. It's rare, but it does happen.
Yeah.
So what I do is that I think about them. I don't think the process is unique to me. You just think about it, and it gradually forms and connects in your mind. And when I feel that I've got enough of formation there, then I will start to write things down.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it doesn't come full-blown and you're working on it and working on it, revision does have to happen. And I like the connection. I'm not computer literate. I'm not a Luddite, but some people have called me one. And I like the feel between my hand and a pen and the paper.
I'm the same way. I write all my questions for my show still on legal pads.
Yeah.
People think I'm nuts.
I cannot think
as well when I'm using a computer.
I can't either.
Yeah.
And I used to use a typewriter, you know. You remember what a typewriter
is? Oh, yes.
I used to use a typewriter, and that was a good feel. because you had that kind of clackety clack, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I tried to learn the word processor and the computer, there wasn't any, I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't feel anything. There wasn't any connection between my fingers and the words.
Yeah, I find that really important, too. Now, I want to touch on this. During the 10 years that you began writing these poems, your sight began to diminish.
Yeah.
And how has the, what we might poetically call the vanishing light, changed your perceptions?
Well, it forces you to an interior landscape again, to use a cliche. And that's fascinating, because you see things that you don't see if you're trying to look at them and see them. And you let your imagination kind of wander. So I find that not being able to see as well brings on, you know, again, these are all cliches, another kind of seeing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a poem in the book called Night Walk, and that poem is an example of what we're talking about, how you wander in the landscape that you used to be able to walk in and enjoyed walking in through the creek lot and through the fields, and now you can't do that, or you do it at some risk. And I said, well, you know, you take that walk in your mind, and the poem is saying there are different kinds of light, different kinds of dark, different kinds of seeing,
mm-hmm.
and it's true.
Hmm. So it takes you inward, which is perfect for poetry.
I would assume. Perfect for poetry.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And also,
strange that you had picked that before this started happening.
Increasingly, as vision has decreased, I do find, you know, that the poems are growing slimmer, so I'm working now on a new set of poems, and one of them is called The Landscape of Less. And I'm thinking that I might use that as a title for a new chapbook or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
That is a beautiful
title. I'm beginning to get a collection of the shorter work. And we'll see, you know, how that goes. But it's not all that bad. You know, I'm not a Pollyanna. I think I'm a realist. But it's not all that bad. You wouldn't want it to happen to anyone else. But taking what you're given, this is a hereditary thing my family has, is this. There were 9 of us. I had 7 brothers and 1 sister. And out of that set, only one really kept his eyesight.
Really? Wow. Yeah. So in some ways you must have been... Well, I don't know if you can really prepare for this, but you knew that this was a possibility.
Yeah, it's just something that... you know, it happens in some families. If it had happened as a result of an accident or something, I think that I would have had a great deal larger sense of tragedy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But being heredity, you know, you can't escape your...
Yeah. Can I have you read one more poem?
Yes, how about a poem from the Manhattan days? This is a New York poem I'd like to read. It's the last poem in my book. It's called End of the Day. When the sun goes down behind the Palisades, shade climbs up the sides of buildings to rest on rooftops. On Broadway, the barber's pole whirs the evening prayer. People hurrying home from the subway cover their heads with half light, clutch bouquets of wild lilac and shadow. Like a child reluctant to come inside, the light lingers on our stoop.
That's gorgeous. I love it.
Thank you.
Are you writing a lot from memory, from your life, more so than the day-to-day of now?
Up to this point, it's been more memory. I think that there are occasions when I feel the need to write about things that are happening now. There's one poem in the book about 9/11/02, and I felt that I wanted to say something about the anniversary of 9/11. I couldn't write about it when it happened. but I wanted to write about it. And there are other things happening. I have written some poems about the war, though none of them have been published, and I haven't distributed them.
You're talking about the Iraq War?
The Iraq War, mm-hmm. Now, yes. Yes, right. The war, every
yeah, remember
generation.
That, remember that phrase, the war to end all wars?
The war to end all wars, but topical events and subjects do interest me, but so far it's been mainly a matter of trying to integrate these memories of the past into a coherent voice.
And somebody who has spent most of her life as a human rights activist and a peace activist and civil rights and stuff, do you think you ever will come out with a volume of poetry that is primarily political?
I don't know. I've thought about that. I think that the question would be, to what purpose? It seems to me that we always think that, politics and social justice issues, must serve a purpose, must accomplish something. Maybe I'm wrong on that with regard to poetry. But I've thought about it, and interesting you bring it up, because I've been thinking about it recently and wondered whether or not I ought to. Some of the Korea poems are definitely, political poems, particularly if people see the book. The one called Villanelle of Villains is a poem about terror. And it was written about Korea in the 70s and early 80s, but if you read it, it certainly has its application today, unfortunately.
Yeah, yes. But I think of poetry as something that you bring from within yourself to share with the world. That's why I would think political poems would be appropriate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you say, what good would it do? Well, any poem.
Well, it's something you have to say, and I think I'm the kind of person, I don't know, maybe I'm dumb or something, I don't know.
Absolutely not.
But I don't get things for a long time. And then I say, well, is that what that meant?
Well, Peggy Billings, we have run out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we can look forward to a new volume of your poetry. But in the meantime, I really suggest anybody who loves poetry go out and buy her book, Half Light. It's available here in town. It's a gorgeous volume. Thank you so much, Peggy.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.